Good morning, judges. May it please the court, counsel. Judges, our appeal is fundamentally about a juror's intentional failure to disclose her son's fatal motor vehicle accident. This prejudicial non-disclosure deprived my client of its right to a fair trial by 12 impartial, unbiased jurors. This constitutional right to a fair trial should not be trumped by the unfounded application of a rule that has never been applied to a juror's non-disclosure of accident history. And the denial of a new trial under these circumstances is a clear abuse of discretion, which mandates reversal and a new trial by this court. In addition, the trial court committed reversible error by its submission of instruction number 8, which is a partial, impermissible misstatement of the law applicable to this case. Now, this is a case about the non-disclosure of accident history, and Rule 69.025 does not apply here. That rule exclusively applies to litigation history, both by its specific terms and according to the case that foretold the adoption of that rule, McCullough versus Johnson. Also, that non-litigation disclosure limitation is a logical one, because the discovery of accident history by friends and relatives is seldom available in a CaseNet search. But in McCullough,
would it have been discovered in this case, though? If you'd have done the litigation history search in this case, wouldn't the information have been brought to your attention?
Well, Your Honor, in order to find that 69025,
it's a different question. I just want to know whether or not, if you'd done the search, would you have found this information?
Well, Judge, your question presumes that a search was not made. A search was made of a misspelled name that was provided by the court. And I think that BNSF complied with this responsibility under 69025 under those circumstances. To presume that the court later provided information or that the clerk later provided information?
Right. Well, that's a different question, whether or not you had to redo your search once the correction was made, which was before the jurors were seated, right? When was the correction noted?
Well, Your Honor, the record is not clear about when that correction was made. Okay. But if the question is, would a...
I agree that the searching of a wrong name would not disclose the information.
Right.
What I'm trying to do is figure out the facts of this case, whether or not, if you had searched the correct name once provided, would the information that you're now complaining about been found?
It certainly would have, Your Honor, but...
Would it have? I mean, what would you have been looking for? I mean, if you did a prior litigation history, all you're interested in is whether or not they brought an action. Would you have looked into the actual heart of the action? Would it have made any difference to you?
Well, let's back up, Your Honor, and there's some confusion here because the facts are not clear as to when this misspelling was revealed to the parties.
Well, let's just assume that you had the correct spelling at the very beginning and you did a search for prior litigation. Is it relevant as to what the action, the underlying cause of the wrongful death, whether the decedent fell off a ladder or whether he was in a motor vehicle accident? I mean, I understand why you might want to know that, but what is relevant to your search?
I think a CaseNet search would have revealed what it ultimately did reveal in this case, that there was prior litigation by this particular juror that involved an accident. It was most significantly relevant in this case because it complied not only with this juror's statement post-trial, but it was a wrongful death case. And so that makes it even much more clear, and by the way, a wrongful death case involving her son. So it makes it much more clear that this juror would not have forgotten, and during the course of questions in jury selection, there's no way this jury would have forgotten, and that the questions were absolutely clear. So it becomes much more relevant here, but I think non-disclosure of accident history under any circumstances is relevant as to a juror's truthfulness during the course of jury selection.
Can I follow up on two things? One is you're distinguishing between litigation history and accident history, and whether the rule means you have a duty to investigate things that review of litigation history might have shown you, and further addressing that would be helpful. But also, first, can you clarify, you started to, in response to the Chief Justice, you say you did not get the information, you filed the affidavit, you did not get the information about the incorrect name until after trial, is that correct?
That is correct.
But the clerk said she provided two attorneys with that information during the voir dire, and she thought there were one from each side. And did we get a resolution of that issue?
Well, the court's findings are not clear, and they are ambiguous, Your Honor, and contradicted by the record in this case. So when you look at the court's findings, there's a reason why I think that there's this deafening silence there as to what the record shows. And let's talk about those facts for just a moment, Your Honor. To find that 69.025 applies to this so-called, the alleged revelation of discovery, based upon the actual facts in this case, the known record, and the court's actual findings, this court would have to supply facts that contradict the record and make findings the trial court never made. Many of the underlying facts here, Your Honor, are unclear and are ambiguous, and they just don't add up.
Can you be specific? What would we have to find on appeal that you're saying is not in the record?
Okay. So, for example, Your Honor, we know that BNSF conducted a reasonable case net search at the outset based upon the misspelled name, and the court did not find otherwise. And in addition, the court implicitly found that BNSF complied with the reasonable search requirement when it overruled the...
they filed a motion to say motion?
Yes. Well, when the court overruled the plaintiff's motion to deny relief and went ahead and had the hearing. But although the trial court found the clerk credible and BNSF counsel credible in part, there were no other relevant factual findings. And you will note, Your Honor, that the order includes no discussion of any of the other evidence which supported the claim, and the court improperly excluded other relevant and admissible testimony and evidence.
What did the court say it based its decision on?
The court didn't say what it based its decision on.
So we don't know if it found it was unintentional or found it was not a reasonable search or on what basis it acted.
We don't really know, Your Honor. There was neither a sufficient record nor adequate findings to determine whether there was a timely revelation of the misspelling or that counsel failed to comply with the rule thereafter.
So the question in front of the court is, was a reasonable investigation done? And let's just say for argument's sake that that your counsel did the investigation when the list of prospective jurors was given to you. It now comes up on the day of trial. You discover that Ms. Cornell's name really is Cornell, not Carnell. And it's before voir dire, but she only find out this information right before voir dire. Is a reasonable investigation require then a second search to be done by you, or are you not expected to do any further research when it's the day of trial before voir dire that you find out this misinformation?
I think if all of these hypotheticals were actually true and supported by the record here, Your Honor, there would have been an obligation.
Is that practical to do?
Given that additional time. But the record is unclear in all of these respects, Your Honor.
But is that practical to do a second investigation at the courthouse the morning of trial? Is there time? Is that reasonable, practical?
It is not clear from this record because, as you know, Your Honor, there is no other contemporaneous record that this actually occurred.
My counsel, is that, well, are you...
assume 69 applies. Mm-hmm. You have the burden of proof. I mean, if whether it applies or not, I understand, mm-hmm. It's an open question, a big question, but if it applies, the party seeking post-trial relief has the burden to demonstrate compliance, right? I mean, if the rule applies, it was your burden.
This is correct, Your Honor, and we met that burden, and the court did not find otherwise. And so my point here, Your Honor, is that based upon the objective facts that we know of and based upon the findings that this court, that the trial court entered, it's not clear what happened here. And so for this court to apply 69.025 in a case where we never sought to ask questions about litigation history. The court initiated those questions of a juror under oath, and it was by this juror's outrageous, intentional failure to answer these questions that we were denied a fair trial here.
Counsel, the rule 69C says the court shall give all parties an opportunity to conduct a reasonable investigation as to whether a prospective juror has been a party to litigation. And I think that may be part of what Judge Russell's question was going to. Once you discovered the change in name, assuming it occurred prior to voir dire, was any period given to do further investigation to discover any litigation history?
Your Honor, we have to be guided by the record, and the record here...
So far as the record shows, right?
The record does not reflect any time was given for that. Matter of fact, the record does not reflect anything related to
it. It doesn't reflect when or if you were given the correct spelling.
This is correct.
And it doesn't reflect that you requested time to do that additional
right.
search.
And it doesn't reflect that we were told or given an opportunity to do so, Your Honor. And I would suggest that on this record, it's unreasonable to believe that trial counsel in a $20 million case would not have conducted an additional case net search if they had received this information ahead of time. There's no record of it and no findings on it. It's unreasonable to believe that trial counsel on both sides would not have informed the court of their findings if this case net search had been conducted. There are no findings, and there is no record on it. It's unreasonable to believe that there is no mention anywhere in this record contemporaneous with such an unusual event by the court or by the clerk that there was notification given to counsel, that counsel was given any opportunity or time to conduct this search. So I would say that on the record before you, Your Honor, we complied with all the rules applicable, and even if 69.025 was applicable under these circumstances, it was complied with.
Thank you, Counselor.
May it please the Court, let me answer one of the questions you had as clearly and unequivocally as I can with reference to the transcript. This is at page 64 of the post-trial transcripts. It's part of volume 9 of the transcript that has been provided to you. On line 13, what did you do, this is of Deputy Clerk Wheeler, what did you do with the information that there was a misspelling about Ms. Cornell's name? I advised the attorneys, one attorney from each side, that it was Kimberly, not Kimberly Cornell, it was Kimberly Cornell. Did counsel acknowledge that they received the information from you? I mean, did they act like they heard you? Answer, yes. On the next page, page 65, when did you tell counsel about the misspelling? And ultimately, she said, it would have been, you know, I would have been notified by the clerk who checked the person in, and then I would have advised the attorneys, but I don't know if it was before or after I actually seated the pool. Question, well, whether it was before or after the pool was seated, was it before voir dire commenced? Answer, yes. Clearly, unequivocally, they knew about it before the commencement of voir dire, and we know from the record that it was 4.5 hours from the time voir dire commenced until the jury was seated. So,
Mr. Manners, isn't there a question, or maybe there's not, but I took from the briefs there was a question as to whether she believed these two attorneys were one from each side, but she didn't know who they were.
That's
so
correct.
She may or may not have been correct on that, or do we?
She was absolutely certain she told one of the defense lawyers, but she couldn't remember which of the defense lawyers she told. So there's no question that she told if the evidence...
Why was no record made of this?
Pardon?
We normally deal with things on a record. There's nothing in the record. There's nothing that the court did. Nothing said in open court on that.
I can tell you that I expect the judge was in chambers before voir dire commenced. And he probably wasn't out there. I doubt that the court reporter was in the courtroom at the same time. What we do know is that a seating chart was prepared based on the jurors who actually served that had the correct spelling of Cornell's name. We know that the name was corrected on the master list that was used to conduct peremptory challenges. So the correct spelling was on that list.
Are those items in the record? Are those evidence
yes,
in the record?
Yes, absolutely. And we also know from the transcript that when Judge Mitchell was going through the list of people who were on the jury, as you do after peremptory challenges are made, after strikes for cause were made to make sure they had the correct jury seated, he said specifically Kimberly Cornell, not Carnell, but Cornell.
The master list is maintained by the judge, though, not necessarily the individual attorneys. Well, there's no indication that the attorneys on the other side had corrected their list.
Here's what happened, as I understand it from the record. A list was given to the attorneys after the challenges for cause had been made, and people scratched off the list so they knew how many were left so that they could conduct their peremptory challenges. That list had Cornell's corrected spelling on it. So they took the peremptory challenges off that. That's more evidence that they were given information that the correct spelling was Cornell.
And nonetheless, the trial judge, after this post-trial hearing, found the clerk to be credible and ruled against the defendants. Is that correct?
That's correct. Which is an indication that there's been a credibility determination by the trial judge, which this court, as I understand the appropriate standard of review, ordinarily defers to, because he has the opportunity to view all of the evidence.
Counsel, did you all do a search for this new name?
There's no indication in the record that we did, and I don't believe we did.
So was there not time to do it? Is that why maybe you didn't do it either?
I don't think we cared at that point.
We're trying to decide if this was a reasonable investigation, and if defendant had this information at the 12th hour, you know, was there time for a reasonable investigation to have occurred?
There are two answers to that. Number one, they had 4.5 hours. They had four lawyers there, one paralegal, plus they were partners with a law firm that had 500 more lawyers scattered around the country, and they had certainly Wi-Fi available in the courthouse to do the case net search. Or if they were too busy in the voir dire, they could have called their office and said, we've got a wrong spelling on one of these names, do a case net search. But even if they didn't do any of those things, they had 8 days until the case was submitted to the jury, during which they could have done the search. And had they discovered that there was non-disclosure during that 8-day period, they could have brought it to the attention of the trial judge, who could have voir dired Ms. Cornell individually and asked her, what's with all these lawsuits that you were party to, including a wrongful death case? Why didn't you tell us about that? And he could have excused her because there were two alternates left over at the end of the trial.
Counsel, can you address the second big question, which has been adverted to, which is, assuming for present purposes we were to agree with you that he didn't comply with 69025, that just talks about litigation history. It might be that it would be good to make it broader, but that's all it talks about. It doesn't talk about lying about accident history on the stand, when you're in voir dire.
Actually, it doesn't limit itself to litigation history. If you could put up the first document. If you'll look at the individual copies, I hope the bailiff has provided to you, Rule 69.025E.
I think we're getting there.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's all right.
I've got it up though. Thank you.
Tab 1 that you have is the rule itself, and subpart E says that a party waives the right to seek relief based on juror non-disclosure. It doesn't say juror non-disclosure of litigation history if a party fails to do the following. So the language of the rule isn't limited to juror non-disclosure. They want to write that into the rule.
Well, A says it is. A party seeking to inquire as to litigation history shall make a record. Reasonable investigation means checking CaseNet, which gives litigation history. If you've checked CaseNet, then you're checking litigation history. What requires you to go beyond that? I mean, in the context, and B says if you have reasonable grounds to believe a prospective juror's failed to disclose, inform the court of the basis for the reasonable grounds. All those, as is evident from it, go to litigation history. Whether good or bad, we're trying to, what would best serve the purposes of the rule without some prior case saying it applies more broadly? Why wasn't that reasonable given prior cases interpreting it?
Short answer to your question is, litigation history and the accident were inextricably intertwined in this case because the accident resulted in a lawsuit that was included in the litigation history of Ms. Cornell. And to assume that a reasonable lawyer who does a litigation history search, which they were supposed to do, and which, incidentally, they're claiming that she failed to disclose litigation history as well as the accident.
Right, of course.
Had they done the litigation history and they saw that she had 11 lawsuits for things like a dog running at large, a couple of several collection cases, a speeding ticket, I think, and oh, by the way, a wrongful death case. If you were defending this case, you were defending a wrongful death case, and you saw a wrongful death case on litigation history, do you suppose that you might, if you were doing a reasonable investigation, click on the link to that?
But, and Mr. Manners, I understand your argument and what it would have shown here, but the focus of the rule is that if you want to ask about litigation history and get a new trial because a juror lied about litigation history, you need to check case that first, so that you can square up if they're telling the truth about that. It doesn't go on now, perhaps it should, to say, and anything that would have revealed about lots of different things. They would know maybe about medical issues, about lots of things if you sued your doctor. But we've never done that here. It's pretty draconian to do it after the fact, isn't it, as opposed to revising the rule. I understand your causal argument, but it could go very far then as everything that you would have found out in any of those suits.
Let's look at it from the defendant's standpoint, if we could. If you'll turn to tab 7 in the materials that we have, that's a page out of the suggestions in support of their motion for new trial, and I've highlighted some of the language. And what they said was, had Ms. Cornell told the truth on her questionnaire, or had BNSF been provided with accurate information so that it could have conducted its research on the correct prospective juror, BNSF would have learned that Ms. Cornell had made a claim and recovered money damages for her son's wrongful death in an automobile accident, a claim similar to plaintiff's claim for her wrongful death of her husband in an automobile accident. So according to BNSF's position in the trial court, they said if they'd known the correct information, they could have conducted a CaseNet search, which would have led them to learning about the lawsuit involving the death of Ms. Cornell's son in an automobile accident.
But they also complained about her not telling the truth in response to the questionnaire or to the questions.
And think that through logically to its conclusion. Why are they complaining about her failure to tell the truth in the questionnaire? Because what? They would have conducted a CaseNet search.
Or they would have asked her follow-up questions about it and discovered her bias.
Look at it this way. We had another...
I understand, and I think we've clarified the issues. I get your point of view.
Well, my question is about the rule itself, this idea of intentional disclosure. Does that even matter to the rule? I mean, the rule doesn't distinguish between accidental or intentional disclosure in any way, right?
No,
that's one of the objective things about the rule.
Yes. And here's the interesting thing. This is what would have happened in this case had there been a CaseNet search of Kimberly Cornell and you showed all this stuff. If you look at their post-trial motions that they filed in the trial court, they accused her, I counted it, 22 times of perjury, of being a liar, of intentionally hiding her litigation history. Now, let's say that they did that CaseNet search that caused such angst among them before the jury was sworn or sometime before the case was submitted to the jury. Don't you think that they would have moved to strike her as a juror before she was ever seated in the case had they done that? They have raised the failure of Ms. Cornell to reveal her litigation history as one of their points on this appeal.
And of course they have, but say she'd never filed a lawsuit, but she had a son who'd been killed in an automobile accident, and that the person lied when asked, have you or any close relative been in an accident? That would have been a basis for, if she lied about that, for striking her for intentional non-disclosure. The purpose of the rule, as the Chief Justice noted, is in the case of litigation history not to try to try to decide if something's intentional or unintentional after the fact. But that's a separate issue. There's two separate grounds. The accident by itself would have been a reason, regardless whether she'd sued, and that's the difference.
And if that were the case, if there'd never been a lawsuit filed, then doing a CaseNet search wouldn't have revealed anything anyway.
Right.
But it would reveal what the defendant predicted it would have revealed in this case. But before you even get to that, though, look at it this way. If there was intentional non-disclosure of her litigation history, don't you think that BNSF would have moved to strike her as a juror? They say that in their motion for new trial, which is on tab 6 of your materials, and that's number 6, Mr. Bauer. Paragraph 14, they say, had the correct disclosure been provided about Ms. Cornell, she likely would have been disqualified from serving as a juror, as other panel members were disqualified. And they go on to say, had the court denied BNSF's request to excuse Ms. Cornell for cause, BNSF would still have had the opportunity to exercise one of its peremptory challenges. You can't just ignore the point they've raised as to concealment of the litigation history, because if they're correct on that, then under those circumstances, it wouldn't matter whether she had an accident she didn't disclose, because she was going to be gone anyway. She had 11 lawsuits, or 9 according to their account, some of which were fairly recent, one of which involved a wrongful death case. And even if you don't want to go to the bother of clicking on the link to see what the basis of the wrongful death case was, cases that they cite, like Groves against Ketcherside, say that the concealment of other litigation that is significant is a sufficient basis to strike her. She would have been gone already had they done the CaseNet search. Now, why didn't they do it? If they didn't, I don't know. But they had the opportunity to. They had 4.5 hours or 8 days, depending on at what point they might have raised this with the court, and they chose not to do that. And the question is, should they be rewarded with a new trial because they didn't do a CaseNet search that they had an opportunity to do, whether it's over the 4.5 hours or 8 days? And I would submit the purpose animating this court when it adopted Rule 69.025 was for the purposes of judicial economy and the economy of the parties. Remember, this rule was promulgated in 2010 at a time when the budget for this court and the judiciary generally in this state was very tight. Now, probably that's not true anymore. I'm sure you're awash in money now, and if you go across the street and ask for more, they'll say, well, can we give you even more than you want? That isn't the situation ordinarily, but perhaps it's different now. But I would submit to the court there is not a sufficient basis to order the drastic step of a new trial in this case and cause the imposition on the budget.
Why did the court overrule your motion to determine BNSF's entitlement to seek post-trial relief based on alleged juror non-disclosure? Wasn't that based on Rule 69?
Of course it was, Your Honor, and that's a good point, and I'm glad you raised it with me. What happened in this case is on May the 27th, 2015, the defendants filed their motion for new trial claiming non-disclosure. They did not demonstrate that they had complied with Rule 69.025, which is required by subpart F. On June the 18th, I believe, the plaintiff filed a motion to have them to determine BNSF's entitlement to seek post-trial relief, claiming that they hadn't done what they were required to do. And if you look at tab 8, it's got the last, next to the last page of that motion filed by the plaintiff, and it said, wherefore, plaintiff presents the court with a proposed order compelling defendant BNSF to demonstrate its compliance with Rule 69.025 prior to examination of Ms. Cornell. The order is under tab 9, the next tab, and it asked, if the court had signed it, it would have ordered that on or before July 1st, 2015, prior to examining juror Cornell, BNSF demonstrate its compliance with Rule 69.025. Now, at the time the court ruled on that motion, it had already conducted an evidentiary hearing on August the 20th, where it heard the testimony of Wheeler and one of the defense counsel, and it determined that Wheeler was credible when she said, I told lawyers for both sides about the correct spelling of the name. If the court had granted that motion asking that they not be allowed to have an evidentiary hearing, it would have been nugatory.
You're saying it's moot at that point?
Absolutely. And that only makes sense. And if there's an ambiguity caused by the fact that the court overruled that motion, but at the same time found that Wheeler was credible as a witness, then you resolve that ambiguity by looking at the record as a whole, including the motion that was being overruled.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, how do you respond to the argument that not only did you have 4.5 hours, but you had 8 days to do the search and raise this irregularity to the trial court when it could have been cured and avoid any implication that you were sandbagging?
What I'm going to tell you, Your Honor, is that Mr. Manners respectfully is telling you what he thinks. And I will tell you what I think and what the record clearly shows. It didn't happen, Your Honor. There's a reason why the findings are ambiguous in this case. And so this court cannot assume facts in a court with a result reach when the facts and record are ambiguous and contradicted by the record and the known facts here. Now, if there had been a correction and counsel had been informed before this jury was sworn, the clerk had a duty to make a record of it. And there is no record and no findings on that issue. If there had been a record and counsel had been informed, the clerk not only had a duty to make a record of it, had a duty to inform the court. And the court shared that same duty to make a record and also to inform counsel of the time they had to conduct a reasonable search. No record of it, no findings of it.
So you're saying that we should find that the trial court abused its discretion by finding the clerk to be credible during the post-trial motion?
I'm not saying you should find that, Your Honor. What I'm saying is what I started with at the beginning, is that this is not a 69.025 case. Any findings related to 69.025 and the supposed 11th hour discovery of a misspelling requires this court to rely on findings that are not there and to create a factual record that's not supported by the known record in this case. I invite the court to look at the record here, and you will see that it's not clear when the jury list was corrected or when the transcript was corrected to put in the correct name.
What meaning are we to give then to the finding that the clerk was credible? Cindy Wheeler was credible.
Well, when Judge, I think we must use our common sense. Quite frankly, this is the judge's clerk. Okay? But the judge would only go so far here. I think this court should limit its analysis to the fact that the complaint that we made in this case was with regard to non-disclosure of accident history and not wade into that. Because I think we have to use common sense about what happened here and look at the record that's before you. We know that this juror withheld the truth and caused the injustice.
Now, if it is a Rule 69 case, why does it matter whether it was intentional or unintentional? I mean, isn't that what the rule was clearly designed, if it applies, to put the burden on lawyers at a time when the trial judge could fix it? And there's no doubt in this case that the trial judge was working off a correct list. The trial judge found that the clerk applied it to both sides ahead of time. So why does it matter? I mean, I thought that was the rule itself makes no distinction, like the cases prior to the rule, about intentional and unintentional, or for that matter, ambiguous or unambiguous questions.
Right. Well, the cases, Your Honor, that deal with non-disclosure address those issues, that is, whether it was intentional or not.
Right, and that may very well go to whether or not Rule 69 applies in this case. But if it applies, does it make any distinction at all regarding the basis of non-disclosure? In other words, it doesn't put the obligation on either party if it's intentional or unintentional. It puts the obligation on the parties only if you want to complain about juror non-disclosure of any type. If the rule applies.
But keep in mind, Your Honor, the rule also puts an obligation on the parties to inform the court about a non-disclosure. Mm-hmm. And there was no such information given here. And if this, in a significant case like this, Your Honor, it's unreasonable to believe that if this information had been given before the jury was sworn, that counsel would not have conducted such a search. And if such a search had been conducted with the corrected name, that information would have been available, and there was a duty, both under 69.025 and under the ethical rules, to inform the court of this. To affirm the trial court's ruling in this case would, in effect, excuse or sanction a juror's outrageous conduct in this case, which denied my client a fair trial. My client has a constitutional right to an impartial, unbiased jury. This juror repeatedly was untruthful, not only to the parties, but to the court after the court gave a stern admonition about the significance of these questions.
If, in fact, the court's ruling supports that you were told as to the name change, is it reasonable, or do you concede it's reasonable for the attorneys to have recognized the significance of the name change so that they would have known to do the search?
If there had been sufficient time allotted, Your Honor, and the record is unclear about that, I submit the record shows that that time was not allotted. If the court wishes to expand 69.025 to apply to circumstances such as hypothetically applied here, then prospective application, I think, is appropriate. But to retroactively apply 69.025 under the ambiguous and murky facts on the record before you here is unjust and unfair.
Thank you, counsel. It's a well-argued case.
Thank you.